Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 9, Text 32, in which Prahlad Maharaj makes a point to Lord Nrsimhadev. It's actually a very important point because this is misunderstood by Murhas. This point is misunderstood by Murha, means rascals and fools. I particularly use that word Murha because that's the same word that Lord Krishna uses in Bhagavad Gita to describe the rascals and fools who consider avadhanandimam Murha, manashing tanamashritam, param bhavamajananto, namabhuta maheshwaram. Persons who are extremely foolish due to their contaminated envious consciousness, they consider that Krishna is just like any one of us, that because he appears in a human-like form, that he is a spirit soul who is taking shelter in that form. In other words, that he's an encaged, embodied living being. Not knowing the Vedic version, deha dehi vibhago yam neshvare vidyate kvachit. But there is no difference between the Lord and his body, because the Lord is his body. He is Satyat Ananda Vigraha. He is that form. It's not that Krishna has his form. It's not exactly that Krishna has his name, because Krishna's name, form, qualities, pastimes, everything about him is non-different. But persons who are envious of Krishna, they confabulate that Krishna is, they may say, a very special being, as if to give him some extra respect. But actually their so-called giving respect to him, and this is especially referring to the Mayavadis, who they Krishna Paramatma, they'll say, with some apparent respect. But their respect is... It's actually not respected. It's actually insulting to Krishna to consider that, just like they consider that there are different theories the Mayavadis have about Krishna, that he is the embodiment of sattva gun, or he has appeared as an incarnation of sattva gun. But that means that they ascribe a material form to him. Therefore, they're known as Mayavadis. That's why they call Mayavadis, because they think that Krishna is also a product of Maya, that the Absolute Truth is impersonal. Krishna is a person, so Krishna is also a product of Maya. But they don't know the Vedic version, Narakriti Param Brahma, that the Supreme Absolute Truth, His eternal form, is that which appears to be manlike. There's this, in the English language, it's an anthropomorphism, which it's considered that man projects an idea of God. He imagines an idea of God because, well, I'm a man, and so God should also look something like that. So this is actually round the wrong way. It's rather that God thinks of us, and therefore we have man-like forms. Not that we think of Him, and therefore He has a man-like form. In other words, this man-like form that we may at present be inhabiting after going through plenty of others, it is an imitation of the form, the original form that God has, and many associates of the Lord in the spiritual world also have. Human-like forms. We say human-like because it's what would you call it? Anthropocentrism, that we think that humans are the center of the universe, and therefore, just like they show these Star Trek movies and this and that. I mean, I've never been to one, but you can't help. It's so all-pervasive that you can't help knowing something about it. So they show beings from other planets, and I presume that they have human-like forms, maybe something a little bit different, because they must be like a human. So, no, it's not. They think that humanity is the ultimate level of evolution. But no, they got it all wrong. Back to front. It's not that human forms have evolved, but rather they are put into place by the Supreme Designer. So here Prahlad Maharaj is debunking the incorrect idea that the Supreme Lord, it's described in Shastra, that the Supreme Lord lies down on the causal ocean. So he's debunking the idea that Mayavadis have when they read about this, that when he's lying down in sleep, that his sleep, that means he's in Tamahun. It's recently means what? Maybe 20 years ago. Well, that's recent. I'm talking about the temple of Ranganatha Swami in Sri Rangam. So in the history of that temple, that's quite recent because, I mean, actually the temple goes back. That particular temple at that site goes, well, not that particular temple, but the site that Lord Ranganatha Swami has been worshipped there since the Treta Yuga, since Vibhishana brought him there. And even the present temple has been there for quite a few hundred years, maybe 1,000. More than 1,000, yes. So recently, the one new Gopuram was built. That means, Gopuram means the decorated gate at the entrance to the temple. Usually, in South India, very elaborately designed. So there were only three Gopurams in three directions. So at the north gate, I believe, I can't remember. It was the main gate through which most people enter. A new Gopuram was dedicated. And strangely enough, considering the history of the Sri Vaishnava Sampradaya, which is more or less centered in Sri Lanka, although they don't have an official head office. So rather strangely, considering their history in which they this whole Sampradaya came up actually as a protest to Shankaracharya's Mayavad and the Sri Bhasha of Ramanujacharya was written principally to debunk the impersonalist, wholly impersonalist ideas of that Shankaracharya had propounded in his commentary on Vedanta Sutra, Sharira Bhasha. So it's rather strange that that they called the incumbent Shankaracharyas, like a pope position, something like that. They actually call him in English the pontiff of Kanchipura. At that time incumbent Shankaracharya, who's now gone, I guess he's merged in the impersonal Brahman by now. Anyway, he left his body. Chandrasekhar Indran. So they called him to inaugurate this Gopuram. And in his speech at the time, he commented, because Ranganatha Swami, that deity, like many deities in South India, especially in Tamil Nadu, many of the Vishnu forms, they are reclining in sleep, because that's one of the forms the Lord regularly occupies, as described here in this verse. So the Mayavadi supposed to come to honor the Lord by dedicating this Gopuram in his service, commented that this Ranganatha Swami lying in the temple, he's sleeping, that means he's in Tamagun. And then he did, why then people are coming to worship him? If he's in Tamagun, and what benefit will they get from worshipping him? And so many brahmanas, they're engaged in his worship. Brahmanas are supposed to be situated in sattva-gun. So, what is it? Is it they're there? They're helping to raise the Lord up to sattva-gun. What is the idea? The idea is actually he's just expressing his envy for the Lord and his ignorance of the actual fact that this, as described in this verse, that the Supreme Lord is always Turiyavastita Stita. He's always situated in the transcendental stage, beyond the three phases of consciousness. The three phases of consciousness in material existence, which are mentioned here, Jagaran, Swapna, and Sushupti. Wakefulness, a dreamlike state, and deep sleep. But the Supreme Lord is always in the Turiya Avastha, in the fourth condition, which is beyond material wakefulness, dreaming, or deep sleep. He's always in a stage of wakefulness, but that wakefulness is not the wakefulness of a conditioned soul, which is also just like sleeping. The so-called wakefulness of a conditioned soul, that's also sleeping because he's in ignorance. The Mayavadi is accusing the Supreme Lord of being in a state of tamaguna, and he considers himself to be in sattvaguna. He considers himself superior to the Lord. Why then would he want to merge into the existence of the Lord? I don't know. But maybe he's considering he's become more than the Lord. So maybe he's thinking the Lord will be blessed enough to merge into his existence. Who knows what twisted ideas these Mayavadis concoct in the factories of their imagination. So he's considering that the Lord is in tamaguna, himself in sattvaguna, but even the wakefulness, the awakened state in the material condition, the whole condition of the material existence, it's all in tamas, it's all in ignorance. We may say that, well, wakefulness, that is that lends itself to rajagun, and if one cultivates that to sattvagun, and sleeping, that is indicative of tamagun, the mode of ignorance. So certainly in the wakeful state it's possible to be generally in rajagun, and if one specifically cultivates it, one may be situated in sattvagun. But the whole condition of material existence is basically tamasic, in ignorance. Because everyone in the material world is in ignorance. And even if one is superficially situated in sattvaguna, in which one develops various qualities, in which one is, and that's described in Bhagavad Gita, the qualities of a brahmana. But even such a brahmana, if he has the qualities of shamodamattapashocham, shanti arjavam evacham, jnanam vijnanam astikyam, brahma karma svabhavajam. One may be a very pure brahmana who is peaceful, self-controlled, austere, clean, who is tolerant, who is straightforward in his dealings, who is knowledgeable in Shastra, and not only knowledgeable, but he's not simply pie in the sky, but he knows how to, his head's not simply in the clouds, but he knows how to apply that knowledge practically. And he may even have firm faith in the Vedic knowledge, but if he's not a devotee of Krishna, then he's still in ignorance. For all his knowledge, still in ignorance. In other words, one may have so much knowledge, but he missed the point. He didn't understand Krishna. So he's still in ignorance, even though superficially in the mode of goodness, such a person is still in ignorance. However, the Supreme Lord and his devotees, his pure devotees, they are situated beyond the modes of material nature. Sattvam vishuddham vasudeva shaktitam. The position of beyond the modes of material nature is called sattvam vishuddha, vishuddha sattva. The sattva, or the goodness in this material world, that is always mixed with passion and ignorance. So one can never be fully pure as long as one is not in Krishna consciousness. It's not possible. But if one is in Krishna consciousness, then, ipso facto, by that fact alone, he is automatically free from the modes of material nature. Mount Yoga Vichayana Bhakti Yoga Nasivati Saguna Samatityaitam Brahmavunayakam. The condition beyond the modes of material nature is automatically achieved by one who takes to Krishna consciousness with full dedication. He automatically transcends the modes of material nature because the Supreme Lord Himself, He is beyond the modes of material nature. He is Guneshwar. He is the controller of the modes of material nature. Simply by meditating upon Him, as mentioned here in this purport, Dhyana Avastita, Tadgatena Manasa Pashyantiyam Yogina. The yogis meditate upon the Supreme Lord, and by doing so, they get free from the modes of material nature. So how is it possible that the Supreme Lord is affected by the modes of material nature? If by meditating upon Him, one who is within the modes of material nature, Hare Krishna, becomes free from the modes of material nature. So the proposition or the assertion of the Mayavadi that the Supreme Lord is sleeping, therefore He is in Tamaguna, is thoroughly mistaken and envious for all His knowledge, because He is in Tamaguna. Then for all His knowledge and of the Vedic literature, and for all His intelligent elucidation that he came and gave, He enlightened the persons present, that actually the Lord here is in ignorance. That's some conclusion He has drawn based upon His realization after studying the Vedic literature, but His realization is intelligent, no doubt, to make such a comment. Intelligent means He's used His intelligence to think about it, but that is kubuddhi, badly applied intelligence. So he obviously didn't know this statement from Srimad Bhagavatam. Well, maybe he knew it, because actually it's very learned in the Vedic literatures. Of course, the Mayavadis, they don't give much importance to Srimad Bhagavatam, because they think, well, that's a bhakti literature. That's for bhaktas, and we're already above bhaktas. They think that, just like the one time our devotees, some of our devotees, Bhakti Srutamada Maharaj and Rasaraj Prabhu, maybe some others, they went to visit Him in Kanchi. I went to Kanchi quite a few times, but I never went to see. They probably would have allowed me in anyway, because I'm just a Mlecha. That's true. I'm Mlecha, but they shouldn't sing like that. But anyway, he met Bhakti Srutamada Maharaj and said, How is your Nimai? He knew something. He knows something. It's very bad. And he gave His blessings, and His Krishna consciousness spreading all over the world. May the holy name shine all over the world. So he had some appreciation. But what is that appreciation? That's the classic idea of the Mayavadis. It's actually introduced by Adi Shankaracharya, that bhakti is good for the common people because they're simple and sentimental. So let them do bhakti. And later on, maybe in some other lifetime, by doing bhakti, they can come to the platform of jnana. And then they can realize that the God who they are worshipping, Soham, He is I. I am you and you are me, and we are all together. It's all one and the same. So this is the classic misunderstanding of the Mayavadis, by which they dare to criticize the Supreme Lord. They think that, I don't know what they're thinking. I'm thinking that Vishnu is a manifestation of Satvaguna, but also contaminated by Tamaguna. But I'm actually on the platform. I'm liberated. So Vishnu, he's not yet liberated. So Vishnu can come and take some mercy from you. Who knows what they're thinking? Whatever it is, it's extremely mistaken and contaminated. And by the influence of this Mayavad, people are misled. People are naturally attracted to this Mayavad. They're attracted to such things. Because they're rascals. Everyone in this material world is here because we're all rascals. So we have the tendency to be attracted to such views. Whereas if we hear that we have to, most people, if they hear we have to surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they don't like that because they don't want to surrender. They don't want to give. They don't want to give up their sense gratification, and they don't want to give up their sense of independence and overlordship. They don't want to admit that I'm dependent upon someone else. And even if people superficially take to a path of religion, they relativize the Supreme Lord. First of all, they don't really try to find out who he is. They say, yes, yes, we believe in God. But they don't really make much effort to understand who he is or what it means to believe in him. Simply to believe in him. Believe in who? I believe in God. I said, no. You all believe in Joe Smothers, don't you? You all believe in Joe Smothers? Joe Smothers? Joe Smothers? I mean, you wouldn't deny that he exists. You never heard of Joe Smothers? Okay, I'll tell you. He's a person who lives in a terraced house in Swindon in Wiltshire. I'm just making it up. This is just theoretical. Okay, so now you all believe in Joe Smothers, right? Well, take it from me, because I'm a very saintly person, and I've read the Smotherible, which is the equivalent of the Bible. So take it from me. Just believe in me, or otherwise you go to hell. If you don't believe in Joe Smothers, you burn in hell forever. Okay, got that? Okay, so we all believe in Joe Smothers, right? All right, so now you believe in him. All right, now you don't know who he is, what he does, where he goes. Anyway, why should we be interested in anyone living in a terraced house in Swindon? But if we say he lives in a terraced house in the sky, well, that sounds more interesting. He is the Lord of Lords, the God of God. Okay. But then the question comes, well, who is he? If we say you have to believe in Joseph, okay, we believe. All right, finished. Okay, I believe. I accept it. But then if we don't try to naturally you won't try to find out more about Joe Smothers, because why should we? Not very interested and important. But if we're told that there is God who is the Supreme Lord, then we should naturally we should want to know more about him, just to say, well, I believe in him. Or believe, okay, so what? People they put more interest in this what was that you were saying the other day? Yesterday was, who was it? Someone was saying, Beckham. David Beckham. Who was telling me about him? Yeah, someone was telling me about him the other day. Yeah, you were saying he's worshipped like royalty. Was it you who was saying like that? Haridas in Coventry. Yeah. Sorry for my lack of memory. It was only yesterday. So, people, they consider him very important, so they want to know more about him, and no doubt there's magazines explaining what he eats for breakfast and who his latest girlfriend is or whatever. Oh, it was his hairstyle. I noticed in the advertisement he had a shikar. So, what's his latest hairstyle? What's he doing? What's his next game he's going to play? They want to know about him in detail because they're attracted to him. Unfortunate for them, because being attracted to him won't help them in the slightest. Simply entangle in the material life more and more. So, if we're actually interested in someone, we try to find out about him. We want to know more. But most religionists, they're simply, okay, we believe in God. We sing a song to him on Sunday, or at least every Christmas, maybe. Or at least when we get married, or maybe when someone dies. Then we go to the church and we sing a song. But they're not really, you can see that people are not really very interested. Even people who claim to be Christians or whatever. Because they don't know. Or even they'll say that you can't know. In Islam, they say, if we try to present some information, they say, no. You can't know about God. Don't even talk. God is too sacred to be spoken about. then what is the meaning of what is the meaning of God? If he's so far removed from our ability to understand or our ability to perceive, then what is the meaning of God? He just becomes a cosmic order supplier. That, dear God, here's my shopping list for this week. I need this, I need that. Give it, your God. Okay, thanks very much. See you next week. So it becomes meaningless. So actually, if we believe in God, then we have to know about Him. If we to love Him, we have to know about Him. You can't love someone unless you know. You have to know about, because we don't just love someone because we talk. You love God. Oh, okay. What, how are you going to love? Love means appreciation. And then we have to know, what is He doing that we can appreciate? What does He look like that we can appreciate? What are His qualities? That means we have to know. Qualities means that if we say God is kind, God is merciful, all these things. That means we have to know what He's doing, because kindness is not just some kind of impersonal good feeling, good vibes. But kindness is expressed in practical action, practical dealings with others. So, just like in Islam, they'll deny that God is a person. But then if you say, is He kind? Is God kind? Is He kind? Is Allah kind? Yes, He's kind. Yes, Allah is kind. But then that means, what is His kindness? That means that kindness is expressed in interaction with others. And they'll think the expression of Allah's kindness is winning the lottery. He allowed me to win the lottery or some such thing. But that means if the kindness is it's manifest in His dealings with particular people. Even if you take it as He allowed so-and-so Muhammad Ali or whatever to win the lottery, that means that He specifically manifested His kindness upon that person. That means He has volition, thinking capacity, and He individually interacts with others. That means He's a person, because an impersonal force doesn't have specific volition or specific discrimination. So Srimad Bhagavatam teaches us who is God in a way that no other religious process does. And even those who are Mayavadis, they study so many scriptures, they don't give much importance to the Bhagavata because of their denying Krishna, because of their denying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Prabhupada always stressed Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He didn't much use the term God, but he specifically used the term Supreme Personality of Godhead to make the point very clearly that Krishna is that person who is generally referred to as God. But if we say Krishna is God, the conception that people have of God, or the concept they retain about God, that needs to be redefined to understand who is Krishna. If we simply say Krishna is God, then people are okay. They believe that Krishna is God, and they'll walk away believing that Krishna is some Hindu god who is some just like God. It's just some unspoken, omnipotent, omniscient, infallible, but ill-defined also. So Krishna is specifically defined in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the Vaishnava literature. That who He is, what is He doing? Here is described, Prahlad Maharaj is praying to Nrisimhadev, that you lie down on the causal ocean, Karnadaka ocean. Therefore your name is Karnadaka Shaya. It's interesting that Prahlad Maharaj is saying this to Nrisimhadev, who is a different form. We don't find any deity or any picture of the Lord in His Supta Vigraha, His lying down pose, in the form of Nrisimhadev. We don't find that. Then he's in the Narayan Murti, four-handed form, generally four-handed. In Kanchi, I believe it is, he's lying down with two hands in one place. I can't remember which place, but generally four hands. So, Prahlad Maharaj, he knows the science of God. He's Mahajan. He's one of the 12 Mahajans. So he knows that this Nrsimha Dev is non-different from that Narayana who lies down on the causal ocean. Even Brahma also prayed to Lord Krishna like this, that you, from your navel is manifested the lotus from which I am born. So Brahma, in the beginning he was bewildered. He thought that this Krishna, I know Narayana, he is my father. But this Krishna, who is this? It doesn't appear to be the same person. That Krishna is just a frolicking, frivolous cowherd boy. Whereas my father is the mighty, grave Narayana. But then later he realized when Krishna instructed him by showing how he is indeed the source of all Narayan forms. Then Lord Brahma prayed to him that it is from your navel that the lotus sprouts upon which I am born. So those who are knowledgeable in the science of God, Lord Brahma is also a Mahajan, they know that all these Narayan forms are non-different. They are all far beyond the modes of material nature. They know about the Supreme Lord. They know Him, and to know Him is to love Him. But the non-devotees cannot know Him because they do not have an attitude of loving service towards Him. So even though one may be learned in the Vedic literature, and presumably the Mayavadi, especially these Shankaracharyas, they in the course of studying the Vedic literatures, they may also come to know much facts and information about Krishna. In fact, that same Mayavadi, I saw him another time, he was lecturing. He was lecturing on Krishna Lila, because what are they going to lecture about? If it's only aham brahmasmi, brahmasmi aham, there's nothing much to say. I am the Supreme, the Supreme am I. And then what is there to say? So generally they speak on Krishna Lila, or various Leelas of Ram, but their concept of this is that ultimately the Supreme. They don't even consider Him the Supreme. They may even call Him the Supreme. But generally they have the concept of Ishvara, that is Lord Shiva. They consider Lord Shiva to be Supreme. But then what they mean by Supreme is also very perverted, and it doesn't make any sense at all, actually, because they're in Maya. They think they're free from Maya, but they really are Mayavadis because they're in Maya, thinking that they're liberated. Vimuktamani. They consider themselves liberated, but they're not. So this very valuable information is being given by Prahlad Maharaj to teach us and to clear any misconceptions that the Supreme Lord is affected by the modes of material nature. Prahlad Maharaj debunks the envious misconceptions which are propagated by Mayavadis. Now we may say, well, at that time, where were the Mayavadis? Because Shankaracharya came much later. But Shankaracharya, he was only expounding a theory which is always there in human society. There are always Mayavadis. It's not that Shankaracharya founded the Mayavad school, but rather he was preaching it in the present time. Otherwise, there are always Mayavadis. Probably everyone is a Mayavadi because everyone is a witness of Krishna. We deny the supremacy of Krishna. So this Srimad Bhagavatam is given so that we can be free from all misconceptions, know who is Krishna in truth, and thus develop our love for Him. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions about this? Yeah, please.
She mentioned how persons or devotees of Krishna who surrender to the Lord, they become transcendental teachers.
Yeah, I mentioned that, you quoted Bhagavad Gita, how the devotees, they surrender to the Lord and they become transient in this situation by doing so.
And then I was just wondering, how do we understand in that light those verses that Prabhupada gave about devotional service in the modes?
Devotional service in the modes is referred to by Kapila Devi. So how is it that one is serving the Lord within the modes? Well, this doubt is, how is it that one is serving the Lord affected by the modes of material nature if by serving Him one gets freed from the modes of material nature? Well, if we carefully examine what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, then the answer is right there. Mamchayo avyavicharena bhakti yoga nasevate sagunan samatityantan brahmaguyaya kalpate. Lord Krishna says that one who engages in my undivided devotional service, avyavicharini, that means without any motivation, without that means ahaitukiya pratihata. One who approaches devotional service in the mood that I want to serve the Lord purely without any personal motive and without any interruption, then such a person, by such an approach in devotional service, even if in the beginning he's not completely pure, but by taking association of pure devotees who guide him to act in that way, then he becomes free from the modes of material nature. But devotional service that is executed in the modes of ignorance, passion, or even goodness, that Kapila Dev describes, such a person is considered a separatist. That means he has a separate interest from the Lord. He's performing devotional service, but it's not only for the Lord's pleasure. He has some personal motive in mind. So that motivated devotional service, that will not lead us beyond the modes of material nature, because it's executed from the beginning, it's executed within the modes of material nature. So it's very important that we promote pure devotional service. We should not promote mixed devotional service. Then we end up just like any other mundane religion, cheating religion. There's no use to promote Krishna consciousness anything else but what it is, which is pure devotional service. That doesn't mean that we expect everyone to immediately come to the pure stage, but we should make it very clear what is the difference between real religion and motivating religion. Anything else?
So then how, when we are preaching Krishna consciousness and inheriting ourselves first, obviously, and then also other people, they take up Krishna consciousness. People don't start from pure level.
People don't start from the pure level.
So how do we inherit, obviously we can give lectures and
how can we encourage others to come to the pure level? Ourselves also. Tangible steps, Krishna consciousness is tangible. We should preach, from the beginning we should preach the ideal of pure devotional service, and persons who are fed up of this far from ideal material existence, they will be inspired by such an ideal. If we teach them that you chant Hare Krishna and Krishna will pay your grocery bill or something like that, it's not very inspiring, because It just keeps us on the mundane platform. But if we teach that you fully surrender to Krishna and give up all personal desires, this is total purity by which we can live eternally with Krishna in the spiritual world in an atmosphere where there's no envy or lust, anger, greed, envy, or any such polluted qualities, then people who are searching for the ideal, or maybe even persons who are not searching for the ideal, maybe they'll become inspired by that ideal. And how can we bring them up? Well, bring them to the process. The whole process of devotional service from the very beginning is meant to lead us to pure devotional service. That's why Prabhupada, when he was shown this Back to Godhead magazine, in the beginning they were showing people, pictures of people saying, I chant Hare Krishna, it helps me to get through a busy day, or I have a lot of stress, and when I chant Hare Krishna, I feel relaxed. And Prabhupada said, no, don't do like this. Said we should teach that to chant Hare Krishna to develop pure love of God, not for any material benefit. So, yeah.
I feel that an extension of that is some of the existing books on the meaning of kamshi.
Yeah.
Karma kanda.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
It's like it's meant for worldly people, to encourage worldly people.
Right. It's actually, it's from Shastra. This Ekadashi Mahatma, it's from Shastra. But recently someone said, I have this little email conference I have of myself and disciples and a few others. So on the Kutrada Ekadashi, which was recently, on that day someone pasted that in, how by following this you can get sons and go to the heavenly planets. So I wrote in reply that, well, I'm a sannyasi, I don't want to have sons. I don't want to go to the heavenly planets either. So this is to encourage worldly people to take up the practice of Ekadashi. But actually the practice of Ekadashi for pure devotees, the only reason to do so is for the pleasure of Lord Hari. And the only reason for doing anything is for the pleasure of Lord Hari. So that should always be borne in mind. How can we ourselves be inspired in this? Well, if we're not inspired in it, we're in trouble, because then if we're looking for material enjoyment from Krishna, we might think that, well, why should I go through all this trouble? I can just get material enjoyment anywhere and get it on the street. Why should I bother following all these rules and regulations? So we should always aspire for that ideal. That means if we follow this sadhana process, particularly by hearing regularly. And then hearing means we should hear the message of Godhead, not the message of mixed devotional service. So we preach that, hear it, read Prabhupada's books, and we'll always be inspired in that way. And associate with devotees who are aspiring for that ideal. Practice Krishna consciousness seriously.
As an acharya, you that going up with Adi Purusha, but why did they
use so much? If Lord Shiva, who is Shankaracharya, knew that Govindam is Adi Purusha, Raja Govindam, then why did he preach something else? Well, that's described in the Padma Purana, that he did so on the order of Lord Vishnu to make a situation in Kali Yuga that the Kali Yugaites, as Prabhupada used to call them, that would be suitable for them, because people of sinful desires are born in Kali Yuga. They want to be sinful. So Lord Shiva was ordered by Lord Krishna to create, to preach this Mayavadam Asat Shastram, to preach this Asat Shastra of Mayavada. So to create the situation of Kali Yuga, to exacerbate the situation of Kali Yuga, because people who are born in this situation, they want that. They want to be envious of the Supreme Lord. They want a pseudo-religious philosophy which leads to degradation. Actually, Mayavada leads to degradation. There may be a few Mayavadis who practice very strict moral standards, but in general it leads to degradation. I'll explain why. Because the goal of Mayavad, it's not very relishable actually. If you think that you simply merge into some light, then what's that? Only if you're extremely frustrated, if you're suicidal, would you want to stop doing whatever you're doing and just practically become nothing. So it's like a suicidal kind of philosophy. So the goal of Mayavad is not very relishable. And the means to attain it is also not relishable, performing severe austerities. So people, they like to subscribe to this Mayavad idea because that allows them to be superficially religious while denying God and thinking themselves as God, which is really absurd. But they like this idea, but then if you see that the goal of Mayavad is not relishable, and the path to attain it is also not relishable, so people just keep up their Mayavad ideas and go on with all sinful life, because they think that, well, anyway, there's no ultimate God in control, and all paths is neo-Mayavad, all paths lead to the same goal. So it's all the same anyway. Everything's all the same anyway. So whatever you do, anyway I'm God, so whatever I do is lila. These are the perverted expressions of Mayavada that come about. So it facilitates the degradation of Kali Yuga, which people want. This is described in Chaitanya Charitamrita, summarized in teachings of Lord Chaitanya. It's also been discussed in one essay that appears in one book written by Ravindra Sarup Prabhu called, it was originally entitled Encounters with the Lord of the Universe. I'm not sure what it's published. In India it's published as Endless Love. So that's described in there. Those who believe in Lord Shiva. Well, we believe in Lord Shiva. I believe in Lord Shiva. I mean, those who think Him is supreme.
Mm. They are like mostly this person. Yeah. And then you go to look at it, they go to Sarah project, they go to the project, and they get the money and all that.
Mm.
So is it right or is it wrong?
Is it right to take money from people who worship Lord Shiva? It's right to take it if we engage it in Krishna service. Otherwise not. Should be engaged in Krishna service. You find many such people?
Yes, mm.
Mangujarati is not so many, no. You'll find them, they're more worshippers of Amba, yeah, which is similar. Yeah, in South India you find more worshippers of Lord Shiva. You are Lingayats in Karnataka. That's a really strange bunch. I mean, they're not even... It's anyway. And then in Tamil Nadu we find also the Mayava, those who are hardcore Mayavadis, smarter Brahmanas, they also worship Lord Shiva as their main deity. In many big temples of Lord Shiva, especially in Tamil Nadu.
Prabhupada mentions this in one place. I think he performs a play on words with the word Vedanti.
Ah, yeah, Vedanti.
That the Vaishnava chariots have knocked the teeth.
They knocked the teeth out of the Mayavadis, yeah.
So is it that they're not aware of the... Because we're saying that the Shankaracharya is a very learned person.
How do the Mayavadis consider these real Mayavadis, like the Shankaracharyas, what do they think of Madhvacharya and Ramanujacharya, his disciplic descendants? Well, they consider them opponents. They're trained up. I mean, and we're talking about very few people here now. The Shankaracharyas train their intimate disciples in how to argue on the basis of Vedanta philosophy with the very few followers of Madhvacharya and Ramanujacharya. Ramanuja line, there's hardly anyone. Madhva line, they still have people. They get together and they have a debate and then they go away and they both continue with whatever they're doing. So they consider them philosophical enemies, but they have the... like you say, it's a patronizing attitude. The Mayavadi, the Vaishnava Acharyas, especially in Madhva line, they consider the Shankarites to be demons. They even consider Shankaracharya to be a demon. They don't accept that he's Lord Shiva. They say he's an incarnation of Kala Nemi. We have a few differences with the Madhva Sampradaya on a few points. So they're very heavily against him, but from the Shankarite point of view, they think, well, that's just they're just following another way. They put them all inside their all-pervasive package. They have a slot in there. Yes, it's just another way. They're against us, but anyway, it's just another way. That's why people often can't understand that why devotees preach so strongly and heavily, because they have the misconception that a sadhu should just be very nice and tolerate everyone and everything, because that's what Mayavadis do. Whereas devotees, they repeat what Krishna says, Namam Dushvijina Mulha Prabhadyam Tenaradamaha Maya Pahrita Jnana Asurum Dharmashvitaha. Krishna says, those who do not surrender to me are rascals. And maybe in any one of four categories, but anyway, they're all rascals. So this is the Vaishnav stance, that sadhu means one who cuts away the misconceptions of others. Whereas Mayavadi means one who fosters the misconceptions, that everything you do is all right. And then gradually you can become purified. Ideas are very strange. So these ideas, even in the Western world, people think that, well, you know, a priest, or a monk, they should be very peaceful and very nice. But Lord Jesus himself, he wasn't like that. He came into the, as described, he came into the temple and he threw all the people who were performing animal sacrifice. He was very angry, threw them all out. And then he was also, he was just walking along the shore and some fishermen were there and he told them, okay, just leave all this, leave your families, forget it all, come and follow me. I will make you fishers of men. So he was, if Jesus came now and preached the way he preached, they wouldn't, the Christians wouldn't like him at all. He was a heavy personality. He was a guru. Guru means heavy. But they, by the Mayavad influence, they think guru means fluffy, very light. He just smiles and blesses everyone, he's nice to everyone. Just like this rascal Ravi Shankar, so-called. He's a very popular so-called guru at the present time. Not these sitarists, as you guys come up. He's from Bangalore. So it's a black spot on Bangalore. So his so-called philosophy is that my aim, I read it once in a booklet, I was reading from the dentist. My aim is to put on a smile on the face of everyone I meet. And people think, wow, this is wonderful. But they're just a complete rascal to say such a thing. That I put a smile on your face. In other words, to help. His whole thing is like some kind of new age personality management, how you can cope with life. It's called the art of living. How you can cope with it. It's nothing religious at all. He says that. It's nothing religious. But at the same time, he's posing as a Hindu guru. So why should you put a smile? All right, but the smile should be the smile of understanding Krishna. But his smile is just how to cope with life and feel happy. Whatever situation you're in, feel happy. And this is rascalism. You should feel ill. Rather, a sadhu should teach you that, oh, you're feeling miserable? Well, you should be miserable because the material world is miserable. Surrender to Krishna. But rather, he's teaching some kind of process by which one feels comfortable in material life, which is just cheating. The duty of a sadhu is to teach you that this material world is miserable and how to come out of it by surrendering to Krishna. So many times I saw these so-called gurus, people going, oh, please give me a blessing, my eyesight is going, oh, yes, yes, God will look after you. But what is this rascal doing? Your eyesight is going, that's a sign you're getting old, that's God's mercy, that you better get serious about Krishna consciousness soon. But God, your eyesight won't be better. Well, you're an rascal. And people think, oh, that's very good. He's helping us. Helping the person. So we should be very careful. It's very easy for us to, it's comfortable for us as a movement to fall into these slots that people expect us to fit into. Just like we distribute prasadam and people, oh, feeding the poor. Okay, very good. That's really religious. But actually Prabhupada didn't like that. He wasn't against feeding the poor, although sometimes he spoke against that. But he wanted prasad and distribution. He didn't want people to think of us as another mundane welfare institution. Or it's very easy that people, we identify, okay, Hindu, all right, Hare Krishna, Hindu, okay. There's a box, packaged, sealed, Hindu is written on, okay, we know, all right, Hindu. They fit in this package. But rather, that makes people feel comfortable. We know where they belong. There's some material designation on them. And then we also feel comfortable because we can relate with them like this. But rather, we should present that we don't belong to any material designation. Culturally, it could be considered, from the mundane viewpoint, that Krishna consciousness is a manifestation of Hinduism. But rather, we should educate people that it's not, we don't belong in this box with Vivekananda and so-called Paramahamsa Ramakrishna. We don't belong in a box with all these bogus gurus. We're not part of that. Krishna consciousness is transcendental, beyond the modes of material nature. This is real religion. It's not just another religion that someone can take up if they like. But this is the only necessity for every human being, for every living being. It's not just some kind of optional religion that if you're feeling kind of weird and not very British, you can take up. This is Jaiva Dharma. This is the intrinsic necessity of the soul. It's not just another religion. Okay. Krishna consciousness, Hinduism, another religion. Okay, very good. We'll give you a grant. Sit down, boy. Be quiet. And you know, treat you like a good obedient dog. And then they'll give you some bones. Okay, here's a grant. We play their game and they'll play our game. But no, we should teach Krishna consciousness beyond the modes of material nature. It's more difficult. It's a struggle. But if we don't do that, then we'll just become part of modern society, which is what they want. And sometimes we think that's the highest perfection of the Krishna conscious movement, if we become accepted as a bona fide religion. So, don't mind me, this all sounds very radical, but I don't know what your perspective on all this is, but I would think if we're accepted as a bona fide religion by people whose bona fide religion consists of eating roast beef and all these kind of things, it's probably, of course it may facilitate our work and all this kind of thing, but I think we should be very careful of being accepted as a bona fide religion by people who don't know what bona fide religion is. Rather, we should teach them what is bona fide religion, and we might give them a certificate. Rather than them give us a certificate. Hare Krishna. Yes.
First, I think it was in the purport that's mentioned about the three phases of sleep.
Yeah. Three stages of consciousness. Wakefulness, sleep, dreaming state, and deep sleep. Jagaran, Nidra, Sushupti.
Now they're not present in someone who's trying to go to the city.
Yeah. Although they are, but that's mentioned here, that's described in the next paragraph. Yoga Nidra. One of the stages is given Nidra. So that is one of the stages of material consciousness. But then Prabhupada clarifies that in the next paragraph. Yoga Nidra of Mahavishnu. He's not Ajna, he's a conscious. It appears to be like Nidra means a dreaming state. So dreaming state is just all nonsense, you know, all kinds of weird things coming in dreams generally. But the Nidra of Mahavishnu is also nonsense, but it's real nonsense. It means his dreaming is the material world, which is nonsense. But it's substantial, also it has some modicum of reality. So our dream is simply some kind of, who knows, I don't think the, who would that be? Neuropsychologists, that would be their business to examine dreams. I don't think they can explain what it is. They don't, actually there are many things in modern science which they can't explain. One of them is why we need to sleep. And then if they can't explain that, then it's very unlikely they can explain why we dream or what actually is the nature of dreams. Our dream, it's simply, generally it's just some nonsense, but the dreaming of Mahavishnu, that is something meaningful, something comes out of it. And of course, we see that Krishna, he hardly sleeps, because when he's supposed to be sleeping, he's out actually in his Rasa Lila, his apparent sleeping. But even the sleeping of Krishna is not like the sleeping of the condition, so he's conscious at the same time. Yeah, sorry if I cut you out, but I'm kind of just making a little clarification.
That is the kind of inquiry I was reading, what you spoke on about. I'm thinking specifically in relationship to realized souls.
Yeah. Realized souls appear to sleep. That is described. One devotee was with Prabhupada while he was resting in the afternoon. He used to rest for 1.5-2 hours in the afternoon. Every so often, Prabhupada would wake up and speak to him about various things about preaching. He'd say, "Have you ever been to Allahabad?" The devotee would say, "No, Prabhupada," and go back to sleep. And then Prabhupada would open his eyes again after some time and say that we have to distribute more books, and then go back to sleep again. So his apparent sleep is... it's an interesting... the point is that he's absorbed in transcendental consciousness. But it may be that, at least superficially, the body needs some rest also. Although oftentimes we see in the case of Srila Prabhupada that he often appeared to have material necessities or material deficiencies of his body and got sick. But then at other times, it was shown that just like he would travel all over the world and never have jet lag, which is, how is that? And he would, whatever time he arrived, it just fit into his schedule without making up on extra rest. And so that, that's like, how do you do that? So he would appear to be sick, but at other times, he would show that he wasn't sick in an ordinary material way. That's why in Gaudiya Vaishnav language we say that, for instance, you say such and such an acharya was manifesting his pastimes of illness. And Prabhupada explains in the case of Madhavendra Puripad that he manifested a pastime of illness to give his disciples the chance to serve him. And just like, for instance, Prabhupada, he was so sick he couldn't eat anything. He wasn't eating for days on end. And then his sister came, and she insisted on cooking a big feast with all rich foods and mustard oil and lots of chilies, which even when Prabhupada was healthy would make him sick. So then the devotees would say, "No, Prabhupada, you can't eat this, otherwise your body can't take it. You won't survive." And Prabhupada angrily chilling, "Just don't tell me what to do." Prabhupada had a whole huge plate of all mustard oil, chilies, and digestive oil. And then the next day he went back to his pastimes of not being able to eat even a little bit of fruit. So it could be a complex topic. The states of consciousness and how a liberated soul lives in this world apparently in contact with it, but not. Inconceivable.
I also wanted to ask about another thing you mentioned. You mentioned how impersonalists, they oftentimes consider that black bhaktas, I was saying, they patronize the bhaktas, and they consider that if you perform devotional service of bhakti, then you should be, to the level of realizing jnana.
Then you give up bhakti, yeah.
Yes. So I'm kind of curious, because I never really understood. Where do they get that idea? Because, at least according to...
They get it from Shankaracharya. They didn't get it from Prabhupada.
But what about, do they study Bhagavad Gita? Because
they study Bhagavad Gita, but they study with Shankaracharya's commentary. They're attracted to that those misconceptions. Generally, people take whatever philosophy suits them. Whatever is suitable for their sense gratification. What goes on in the name of philosophy... You can study all these different philosophies, but they're all different justifications for people to engage in sense gratification and however they want to enjoy it. And sometimes we present Krishna consciousness also in a way that we think will be pleasing to people, because we know that we don't tell them all the rules and regulations, because if they think, "Well, I have to surrender," "Well, I don't like that. If I have to give up this and give up that, I don't like that." So people are generally attracted to philosophies which justify their sense gratification. So the Mayavadis, they have a very sophisticated kind of sense gratification, that they reject this material world as miserable, but they want to enjoy the sense gratification of thinking themselves God. So they misinterpret Bhagavad Gita in that way?
So then it's just a question of, the different philosophers discussing what this Sanskrit word means.
That's what it comes down to. That's why they have very complex discussions with the Mayavadis, with the Madhvas. We can't even enter into those discussions. They're so complex. One time Prabhupada was at this well-known incident. Prabhupada was at a Pandal program with so many Mayavadis, and so many people had been invited, and Prabhupada was speaking last because they knew that all the people had come to see Prabhupada with his dancing white elephants, his Western disciples. They knew that if Prabhupada spoke, then everyone would go away and they wouldn't listen to the Mayavadis. So the Mayavadis going on boring, on and on and on, and eventually Prabhupada came on and said that they have said so many things, but we will make more spiritual advancement simply by taking Krishna prasad. It took a little bit of school. And we made more advancement than all these Mayavadis talking so many things just by honoring one last guru offer to Krishna. Prabhupada, a big kirtan, cleared away all the dust of this Mayavad discussion. So, yeah, you can discuss, and those who are attracted to that, they'll be attracted. But there's no bliss. There's no bliss of bhakti. They won't get it. Ultimately, one has to choose. Even if God himself came and stood in front of you and said, I'm God, I'm Krishna, if we don't have the attitude to accept him, he'll reject him, as did Duryodhana. Krishna told Duryodhana, look, don't fight. You're going to lose because I'm on the side of the Pandavas and I'm God. And he said, well, you're God, what is this? And so Krishna showed his universal form. Still, Duryodhana wouldn't accept it. He said, it's just some magic trick. So you can't convince people who don't want to be convinced by any means. Matiya na krishne paratasvato vamito vipadyeta grihavitana. Persons who are sworn to avoid Krishna, who have made a very strong vow that I shall not be Krishna conscious under any circumstances. There's no way to convince them by any means, by philosophical discussion, by any means, by very fair presentation, no mean, because they're determined, I shall go to hell, I shall enjoy my senses unlimitedly. So what can you do? You can bring a horse to water.